A private dinner in December 1900 changed everything. At New York's University Club, J.P. Morgan sat beside Charles Schwab, listening as the young steel executive painted a vision so compelling that Morgan decided to create U.S. Steel, a corporation that would reshape American economic life for decades. This wasn't just another business deal. It marked the beginning of an extraordinary era when a handful of men wielded more power than most governments, when financial empires rose and fell with dizzying speed, and when the very nature of American capitalism transformed beyond recognition. The timing was perfect. Prosperity had returned after the 1893 Depression, McKinley's business-friendly administration provided stability, and America stood poised to enter a new century of unprecedented wealth concentration. In the 1870s and 1880s, fierce competition devastated profits through price wars and overproduction. John D. Rockefeller pioneered the solution: eliminate competition through consolidation. The breakthrough came in 1888 when New Jersey allowed companies to hold stock in other corporations, creating the holding company structure that transformed capitalism. This structure was elegantly simple. Entrepreneurs centralized control by exchanging shares for those of a New Jersey incorporated parent. After the 1897 recovery, consolidation fever erupted. A new breed emerged, the promoter, who combined competing businesses and manipulated stock prices for profit. By 1900, eight powerful groups had reorganized much of the steel industry. One exception remained: Andrew Carnegie, who controlled his entire supply chain. When competitors threatened him, Carnegie authorized a $12 million tube plant. The Schwab dinner became Morgan's catalyst to buy Carnegie out and create the world's first billion-dollar corporation. By 1901, E.H. Harriman had risen from Wall Street messenger to railroad magnate. Three transcontinental railroads dominated the West: Harriman's Union Pacific in the South and the Northern Pacific in Great Northern in the North, both allied with Morgan. When both factions wanted the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad for Chicago access, Morgan secured it first. Harriman's audacious response: buy control of Northern Pacific itself, thereby gaining indirect control of Burlington. What followed was Wall Street's most dramatic battle. Northern Pacific stock rocketed from 101 to 1,000. Desperate short sellers frantically sold everything to raise cash. Interest rates hit 75%. Steel Corporation shares plummeted from 54 to 26. By Thursday noon, half the brokerage firms were technically bankrupt. Morgan and Kuhn Loeb finally agreed not to demand immediate delivery, while banks formed a relief pool. Cornered shorts settled at $150 per share. Though markets recovered, thousands of families lost everything. The peace treaty gave Morgan control of Northern Pacific's board, but included Harriman and William Rockefeller. To secure this arrangement, they formed the Northern Securities Company, a holding company that would soon face Theodore Roosevelt's challenge. The 10 most powerful Wall Street figures: Morgan, Baker, Stillman, Harriman, John Rockefeller, William Rockefeller, Rogers, Schiff, Vanderbilt, and Keene, wielded more influence than politicians, yet attracted less public attention. Most were self-made men without college educations, though they later donated generously to universities. A striking contradiction defined these titans. They were deeply religious men whose business practices contradicted their faith. Morgan was a prominent Episcopal layman. The Rockefeller brothers were devout Baptists. John donated nearly a tenth of his income and eventually gave away over $500 million. Schiff attended synagogue religiously and observed the Sabbath strictly. Yet these church-going men engaged in stock-watering schemes, maintained slush funds for bribing politicians, and showed callousness toward investors and laborers. Their religion blended with Old Testament justice, Franklin's frugality, and laissez-faire competition. The damage they inflicted remained remote and impersonal, victims unseen across ticker tapes and boardroom tables. By 1905, nine appeared in the New York Social Register, their social ascent complete. The 1907 panic erupted when a failed attempt to corner United Copper Stock crashed shares from 60 to 10 in 2 days. Depositors rushed to withdraw funds from F. Augustus Heinze's Mercantile National Bank, draining $8 million from Knickerbocker Trust by Tuesday noon. The crisis spread rapidly, runs hit multiple banks, Westinghouse faltered, and call money rates soared to 125%. At his library, Morgan gathered financial elites for an ingenious solution. Near dawn Sunday, he confronted reluctant trust presidents with a document demanding $25 million. When no one moved, Morgan gently pushed his friend Edward King to sign, breaking the ice. The panic subsided, but consequences followed: economic depression, recognition that systematic bank reserves were needed, leading to the Federal Reserve, and dramatic centralization of financial power. Where many principalities once existed, there was now one kingdom, Morgan's. Reform forces gathered strength. Western farmers, squeezed by debts and exploitative railroad rates, formed the movement's backbone. Champions emerged, governors like La Follette, mayors like Golden Rule Jones, President Roosevelt, and publisher Samuel McClure. When Ida Tarbell's Standard Oil investigation and Lincoln Steffens' municipal corruption exposé appeared in late 1902, the muckraking era began. Reformers didn't seek to overturn capitalism, they aimed to limit industrial captains' unprecedented powers and prevent unregulated commerce's cruelest consequences. When the House Banking and Currency Committee investigated a potential money trust in 1912, the Pujo Subcommittee uncovered staggering statistics. Morgan, Baker Stillman interests held 341 directorships across 112 major financial institutions, controlling over $22 billion. The hearings became dramatic theater when 75-year-old J.P. Morgan testified, striking the table and denying having power, declaring that a man I do not trust could not get money from me on all the bonds in Christendom. George Baker's testimony proved more revealing. When asked if credit concentration was a comfortable situation, Baker slowly replied, "Not entirely," a climactic admission that left spectators sighing. On March 4, 1913, Woodrow Wilson became president, declaring, "There has been a change of government." The old order was passing. Morgan died in Rome on March 31, 1913. Despite regulatory legislation, enforcement weakened dramatically through the 1920s. By 1929, the 200 largest non-financial corporations controlled nearly half of all corporate wealth. The wave broke on Thursday, October 24, 1929, shortly after 10 in the morning. Speculators who had borrowed heavily couldn't meet margin calls, forcing automatic selling. This created a vicious cycle. Simultaneous selling without buyers drove prices down, triggering more panic. By November 13th, $30 billion in capital had vanished, nearly equal to America's entire war cost against Germany. Despite Hoover's reassurances that prosperity was just around the corner, the disintegration continued. By July 1932, U.S. Steel plummeted from 262 to 22, AT&T from 310 to 72, General Motors from 91 to 8. Franklin Roosevelt turned crisis into opportunity. His inaugural address thrilled citizens with his pledge to wage war against the emergency. He acted immediately, issuing a bank holiday, calling Congress into emergency session, and addressing Americans directly through radio. While Hoover believed prosperity would filter down from owners, Roosevelt believed it would seep up from the less fortunate. Most significantly, Roosevelt's program deliberately recognized the end of laissez-faire. Government assumed responsibility for the American economy for the first time in history. The economic initiative shifted definitively from Wall Street to Washington.